You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, August 11th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. On today's program, Bruce Levine, author of Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. He'll talk to us about why our youth don't fight back, perhaps in the way earlier generations of American youth did, perhaps in the way youth from around the world are fighting back right now. Not just the youth that aren't fighting back. A lot of us oldie types that are not fighting back. That and more. We may also today, I should say, hear from Catherine Harris in defense of the recall elections that happened in Wisconsin, and of course, to preview tonight's Republican clown car parade, otherwise known as the GOP debate. But we will get to that as we go. And on today's show, let me start off with this, folks. I got an email. And for the past couple of days, we've been talking. I guess I've lost track of all time, of course. But at the very least, yesterday on the program, we had an extended conversation about what's going on in Britain. And Matt had his idea of it, and I had mine. But this took place all in the member section. And, of course, you know, the member section, you know, could be listened to live. And we also have we took a small clip of it from the members section yesterday and put it on YouTube. And there two things I want to talk about before we get to our guest. One is, first off, I've been asking you guys to go to donateyouraccount.com/majorityfm. And let me give you a sense of the implications of this. We have almost doubled, I guess, in the past week or two, maybe more, the number of Twitter donate your accounters and Facebook donate your accounters. It allows us to basically automatically get you to retweet or repost, whatever they call it on Facebook, once a day. And we usually put out, yesterday we put out that YouTube clip, right?
Yeah.
The YouTube counter hasn't caught up to it. How many retweets? Tell me, because now we only have like what, like 200-300 donate your counters on Twitter, and then, you know, maybe 200 on Facebook, more or less. Okay, and so not only are you helping us get the word out, but I want, tell us how much it was.
People clicking on the YouTube link to watch the YouTube video on Facebook, it was 1,450 people. On Twitter, it was 3,316 people.
So we are talking by a measure of times 10. Exponentially speaking, times 10. The number of donate your counters and clicks. That means that when you automatically retweeted this or automatically Facebook posted it because you've gone to donate your account, you reached 10 times the amount of people who actually signed up to do that for us. not only are you helping get the word out about the show, but you're clearly providing a service for those people. Because otherwise, because they must have passed it on to nine of their friends. And so I appreciate you doing it. And I'm glad to know that actually, you know, we're providing your feeds with some value to other people. And I have to say that I don't know if we have gotten more email, short of like, you know, when I talk about my eczema, if we have gotten more email about any other topic. Let me just give you just one example. I don't want to waste your time with this, but it's we've gotten more email and more comments on Facebook and Twitter about this than any one of our topics. It's, hey, guys, this is from Gary. Thanks for playing the Darkest How interview. This was an interview that was on BBC. Do we play this in the post show or the?
We play this in the post show.
Oh, really? Okay. So it didn't even go. Okay.
It is on YouTube as well. Our YouTube
right.
as well.
Okay. And Darkest How is a writer who was interviewed on BBC, and the interview went horribly awry from the BBC's perspective. They had a narrative about these riots that they wanted to push, and Darkest How was having no part of it. Great discussion. And though I'm annoyed at Matt, it happens all the time.
Yep.
I give him Big Fred. Maybe you meant cred. Maybe Fred is a street word that I'm not aware of.
I have no idea.
For discussing this with Sam. It's a wonderful teaching moment in the members section of the show. Incredible. I'm saving the audio. I'll use it with students someday, I'm sure. You think you'd get something like this on Citizens Radio? Now, of course, we're in this big donate your account battle with Citizens Radio. No way. It's all new atheism and tattoos over there. A little too hip for me. Now, Matt, you are completely full of tattoos. I'm ranking Majority Report with Crimes and Misdemeanor era Woody Allen when he kind of had this I've grown up as an artist and need to consider morality in a more complex manner. And then he wanted you to check out this article from the Center for American Progress, which entitled What You Need When You're Poor. I think I touched on that the other day, actually, that piece.
Yeah.
But be that as it may, Gary from Seoul, want to thank you for the email. And I want to thank everybody for the comments, the Twitter comments, the Facebook comments, and also making me feel good about the value of the member section. Sometimes we talk about my eczema or my raccoon wars, and sometimes we get into this stuff. We had a lot of phone calls on the membership. We had like half a dozen phone calls,
too. Yeah, we didn't even get to even half of them.
Right, and for those callers, I want to apologize. Maybe we'll get to you today. In the meantime, we will take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Bruce Levine on 8 reasons young Americans don't fight back, how the U.S. crushed youth resistance. We'll see about that. We'll be right back. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Bruce Levine, he is the author of Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. You can check out his website at brucelevine.net. We'll have a link to that at majority.fm. Welcome to the show, Bruce.
Thanks for inviting me on, Sam.
Really enjoyed this piece in Alternate, 8 Reasons Young Americans Don't Fight Back. Want to talk about some of the themes in your book, of course, as well. But let's break this down. I mean, you say that young Americans, even more so than older Americans, have seemed to acquiesce to the idea that our corporatocracy, our plutocracy, is screwing them over, and there's nothing they can do about it. Do we have a generation, do you think, that it feels the most disempowered of any in modern times relative to their government?
That's my experience. Now, again, I want to be careful. Just as there are adults, there are a lot of adults Americans who have been kind of pacified and defeated and demoralized too. But I think it's especially striking in a young population, because if you take a look at around the world today and in American history, it's young people who are at the forefront of democratic movements. So when you've crushed their spirit of resistance, that's a major coup for the ruling elite. And I also want to quickly add that I'm well aware of, and I pay attention maybe as much or more than anyone, is what rebellions are going out there, and I really want to especially congratulate those young people, and they are out there, who are completely complying to corporate domination out there, and it takes a lot more strength and a lot more guts to do it now than ever because of some of those forces that I describe in that article.
Yeah, let's talk about these. I mean, the first one you put you write down you mentioned is student loan debt. How does this impact? First off, let me ask you: how does it impact the youth? And in this instance, you know, we're talking about a subset of the youth here too, right? I mean, because you know, we have, I don't know what, 20-25% rate of college attendance. So just give me a sense of why you put that as number one.
Well, just some quick facts on that. We have about 60% of American kids do go to college. About 30% ultimately graduate.
All right.
And out of that 30% who graduate, the vast majority of them are carrying student debt, even those who are graduating from public universities. So average debt overall for graduates is close to around $25,000. But you got lots of young people who are at $60,000, $80,000, $100,000, and this is just for undergraduate. And to answer your question about how does that subdue and pacify people, when you have an overwhelming debt of any kind, it creates an enormous amount of fear. It makes it much less likely you're going to buck the system. When you graduate college at you're 20, 21, and even you're still in college, and you start to realize it becomes less and less of an abstraction. That's what happens to some of these young people when they're 18 years old. It just feels very abstract. What's the difference, $20,000, $40,000, $80,000? Well, as you get closer to graduation and you're going to have to start repaying this stuff, it's not so abstract. It's very concrete. And so back in my day, all right, you know, back in the day when in the 70s, 60s, 70s, when you can go, if you're rich, mommy and daddy paid for it, and if you're working class like myself, there are great public universities that you went to. I went to a free university. Many places are either free or low cost, and you graduated without debt, even with advanced degrees. And I got to tell you, if I would have graduated with the kind of debt that these kind of kids had, I wouldn't be bucking the psychopharmaceutical industrial complex, which is what I've been doing for the last 15, 20 years. Maybe I would have, but it would have made it less likely that I would have, because I would have been terrified that, you know, I'm more likely it's going to cost me a job. It's going to economically marginalize you. And all, make no mistake about it, all anti-authoritarianism, all bucking authorities has a good chance of economically marginalizing you, which is really rough when you've got growing debt all the time. So debt is a huge pacifying force, and it's something that we need to talk a lot more about in America.
I mean, that's fascinating because I think that in addition, obviously, to the debt you're in, the ability to get out of the debt, there's two parts of that equation, the size of the debt and also the chances of you getting a job. And I think for people coming out of college in the 60s and the 70s, the idea that you had, first of all, that you had graduated college, but even if you hadn't even graduated or gone to college at that point, there was far more likelihood of you getting a good, steady job. I mean, there was just a lot more opportunity, not necessarily to become a millionaire, but to make sure that you made a good middle-class living. And to a certain extent, that is been severely diminished. At least the sense of financial security in general has been diminished, hasn't it?
I agree with you, but I think it's also important for people to keep in mind that, you know, when you take a look at the what's happened in the Arab world, I mean, they had huge unemployment as well, far higher than us. But what one thing they also did have was their colleges. And you go in the Arab world, I mean, people are not, there's not tuition there. People are not walking around with huge student debt. And one of the real surprising things for me when I talk to young people is with all the internet and all of this stuff, that there's an amazing amount of unawareness that America is one of those few countries out there that young people are having these gigantic tuitions and huge debt. They're not paying, you know, student. There's no there in Iran and where they had their great uprisings in 2009 after disputed elections. Mexico, France, when they try to jack up the tuition a little bit there, you know, the kids are on the street there and they're not letting it happen. And because everybody knows around the world that when you create this huge debt, it's a kind of politically pacifying force. And for some reason here, you know, American students have become pacified, so they accept this. And then you have like a kind of vicious cycle that this student debt has a subduing effect on activism. And then this political passivity makes it more likely that students are just going to accept this debt as a natural part of life. This student debt is not a natural part of life. It did not exist when I was young. It does not exist and still in most of the world.
Is there something that in you know with college students that breeds more political activism? Maybe that's self-evident, but I mean certainly a lot of the protests that we saw back in the 60s, you know, came out of colleges and universities. Even to a certain extent, I mean, obviously you need to have labor in certain instances. You need to have the working class, but when you look even to Egypt, you know, tips of the spears was this, you know, this guy Ghonim, who came, was obviously highly educated, came from, you know, was working for Google, came back into the country. So is that an essential element to any type of political rebellion, is having an element of an educated class?
Well, certainly, I don't know about it depends what we mean by educated class. I mean, if you take a look at the American some of the great movements in American history and democratic movements, and I get into this in a lot more detail in Get Up Stand Up, where I'm not just talking about young people, it's sort of a little bit, I think, upsetting for people who think that college education is tantamount to being best educated in terms of understanding the class war and how to deal with it. Because if you take a look at lots of the great democratic movements in American history, and I go into detail, for example, about the great populist movement in the 1880s, 1890s, which was a kind of insurgent revolt against farmers, against the sort of moneyed elite of that era, the railroads, the banks, and, you know, these exploitative merchants. I mean, most of these farmers had very little schooling. Some of them had no schooling, and they were very politically sophisticated in terms of coming up, understanding what was happening, creating this organization called an alliance, creating these great workers' cooperatives, which were great recruiting tools, and sending 40,000 lecturers out there to explain what was going on, and creating their own people's party. So all of this was done without a, you know, college-educated world, but it was done with educated people. So I think that's one of the other points that I talk about in that piece, that we should stop shaming those young people out there who really care passionately about learning and care passionately about education, but high school's been a turnoff for them. You know, and so, and you know, throughout American history, there's been lots of great activists who that's been the truth. You know, that's been true, and we got to start shaming them. And what I also talk about, we got to stop pathologizing them and medicating a lot of these non-compliant kids.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that's number two, is the apologizing and medicating non-compliance. Talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great embarrassment for me, Sam. That's my business, the mental health profession, which has increasingly become a business. And, you know, one of the sad things that have happened is it used to be routine criticism, pretty, if not mainstream, well-respected criticism. People like Eric Fromm, the democratic socialist, anti-authoritarian, a career psychoanalyst. I mean, he was, you know, the guy was taught undergraduates. The guy was interviewed by Mike Wallace on television in the 60s, 70s. And now what he would say sounds like so radical, the guy would be completely marginalized. He worried at the time, when it wasn't that much of a problem, that the profession, psychiatry, psychology, all this stuff, was going to be used to just manipulate people to kind of adjust to a dehumanizing, increasingly authoritarian, non-democratic society. And so now, as that problem has become a lot more severe, it's less talked about in my profession. And so, in fact, sort of ironically, the same year he dies, 1980, Reagan becomes president, America becomes more authoritarian, and that same year, the American Psychiatric Association publishes the Bible, the Diagnostic Bible for my business. It's something called the DSM. And so we're right now up to the DSM-4. They're trying to work on DSM-5 now. But back then, it was the DSM-3, and they introduced these diagnoses that still exist that have grown increasingly more popular that basically pathologize, medicalize rebellion. For example, one of the most obvious ones, and I'm not joking here, Sam, I know some folks I talk to in the media think I'm being sarcastic, but there's something called oppositional defiant disorder. And
my daughter has that. My six-year-old daughter has that, definitely.
Yeah, well, if you take a look at almost every person in, you know, who's been ultimately a kind of activist in American history, they've had this too. And, you know, a lot of them, have learned, that, there's a big difference between, between defying all kinds of authorities that maybe are legitimate, who do care about you, versus maybe it's a good idea to be defying authorities that don't care. I mean, these symptoms for this thing are often actively or refuses to comply with adult requests or rules. Well, take a look at Saul Alinsky, take a look at Emma Goldman, take a look at Tom Paine, Malcolm X. Every activist was like that when they were a kid, and a lot of them learned to start channeling that anti-authoritarianism to people who really didn't care about him, who really were ruining their lives. But what has my business done? The mental health profession, because they're increasingly controlled by, it's one more industrial complex in America. Now they're increasingly controlled by the pharmaceutical companies. Same kind of things that go on in the military industrial complex, revolving doors of employment, funding of the American Psychiatric Association, all that kind of stuff. Well, they increasingly pathologize normal behavior, maybe things we don't like. Maybe parents don't like their kids are often arguing with them, but it's not a disease, and it's certainly not something you should be giving them antipsychotic drugs like Zyprexa and Risperdal for, and that's what's happened. So these drugs are now like the largest grossing class of drugs in America. Antipsychotics, $16 billion a year. How many schizophrenics are walking around in America? Well, there aren't that many, okay? The reason why it's $16 billion a year industry is the pharmaceutical companies figured out a way to get people to use these things for old people in nursing homes, for stubborn kids, and all that kind of stuff, and that's, I got to tell you, one of the great reasons that I got into this sort of mental health treatment reform movement is because I realized, my profession has now become an incredible embarrassment. It's not just psychologists being used at Gitmo as part of the military-industrial complex. We've got our own thing going here. Mental health professionals are there's about, we see about 20% of young people out there now. There's an army of us. There's a million psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers. And I guarantee you, no teacher has ever referred a kid to tell their parents to go take them to a shrink because the kid's too compliant.
Right.
Nobody's worried about a fascist America. They're all worried about, all these kids who get referred are so-called disruptive.
Right. And they throw all sorts of drugs at them because it's I couldn't agree more with that. But and it raises another question that I wonder about. In addition to that, does, because I think that I probably have that oppositional disorder myself. Unfortunately, it was untreated. Otherwise, this show would be rather boring. But do you think it's possible that there's also something that's going on, and this is not on your list, and it may be just sort of a subsidiary thing, but it raises an interesting question to me. When I think about my relationship with my daughter, I think about my relationship with my parents, and I see my friends in the way that they raise their children too. Do you think, I literally often worry about the fact that my relationship with my daughter is such that she is not having, she is not developing the proper amount, in my estimation, of distrust of authority at this young of age. I mean, honestly, I mean, I think, I mean, there are times where I actually contemplate that, that, you know, I have a different type of relationship with my daughter than my parents had with me, and one which I think she has, frankly, slightly more trust in the things that I say and do. And I worry about that she's not getting enough proper distrust of authority.
No, I hear what you're saying there completely. I'll tell you kind of sort of parallel for me. One of the things that frightens me is when I talk to young people, you know, and that's their only experience of a psychologist, of a mental health professional, and they walk away feeling like this is a pretty good profession, and they're going to trust future mental health authorities. That frightens me. You know, I think maybe I've done more harm than good by being somebody that they feel like they like and they respect, because they don't realize the vast majority of my profession is being sort of trained to be what Howard Zinn called the guards, you know, of the society, that are trained to kind of subdue them. And so, it is interesting. I wouldn't worry too much, though, Sam. For your kids, they're going to get plenty of experiences of authorities who it'll be very easy for them to delegitimize their authority, and they'll learn the proper distrust of authority. I don't think you have any great fears they're going to run into enough of those people out there that you have to be one of them.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to know that. One more thing I want to touch on. This stuff is fascinating to me, and I really appreciate the work you're doing. And to be honest with you, I got to get your book, the Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populists, Energizing the Defeated and Battling the Corporate Elite. We'll make sure we put that on our site, and I'm going to read it, and we'll have you back to talk about it. But I want to talk about one more element of this, fundamentalist religion and fundamentalist consumerism. I imagine to a certain extent this fundamentalist religion has been around for a long time, and it's fairly obvious to me that it teaches a proactive compliance to living within an authoritarian regime. I mean, that's almost the very definition of a fundamentalist lifestyle. But talk to me about this fundamentalist consumerism, because that to me, I think, is a fascinating subject, particularly when we're seeing what happens to it when like in the situation of the British riots, where sort of like it mutates, where people are trying to strike back at society by grabbing a TV because they feel they're owed something in that context. This consumerism even impacts, I think, the way that rage is expressed.
Right. It is hard to say what the number one religion in America is fundamentalist Christianity or fundamentalist consumerism. But I think one thing, I guess we should both define exactly what I mean by we should define the term fundamentalism. And really what that means is a kind of a narrowing of one's focus. I mean, so this is not a critique of spirituality or even there's all kinds of interesting religious people who are deep thinkers out there, you know, but fundamentalism means that you've kind of narrowed your focus and you've inhibited your critical thinking to some sort of dogma. I'm not also opposed to buying and selling of things, but fundamentalist consumerism means that, you know, your whole life is narrowed to just, you know, buying stuff as a way of feeling better. And there's huge problems in terms of this kind of fundamentalist consumerism and having real democracy. I mean, one is that you can't have democracy when you have people who don't really have some sense of self-respect and feel self-reliant. And when you have this kind of fundamentalist consumerism, you buy into it, it just destroys all self-reliance. It gets people feeling like they just have to buy things, you know, turn over their decision-making to authorities to fix things, you know, and it just is the precise kind of mindset that people who are in control, they love to see. And also what it does is it gives people the illusion. One thing I didn't put in that piece, which a couple days later, I said, yeah, I left out one thing, but it also rolling around in my mind, is that what happens is that it's this kind of pseudo-choice that people at some level, you know that they don't have any real democracy. I mean, what the hell, they have a choice between, you know, Democrat and Republican, pro-war and pro-corporatist candidates every year. I mean, you know, this is not a real choice, but so they substitute this for a Coke versus Pepsi, Reebok versus Nike. And so it gives them this kind of pseudo sense of choice, but no real power over their life. So that's a subduing a thing. And it also, more subtly, well, maybe not so subtly, it just kind of legitimizes. You have a society, American society, that legitimizes sort of advertising, manipulation, propaganda, and really lies. I mean, it legitimizes that it's okay to manipulate the crap out of your, you know, 7 and 8 year old. It's okay to manipulate them to get their daddy to buy something. What the hell kind of society is that? And what that does when you have that kind of society, it destroys people's ability to trust one another. It destroys solidarity, because and without solidarity, you know, the key things to have any democratic movement are guts, courage, and solidarity. And certainly fundamentalist, you know, consumerism does a job on that. It also just creates more self-absorption. You're not going to have solidarity when people don't understand the difference between self-respect and self-absorption. You know, so there's a lot of problems to it, and I think a lot of agnostic or atheist progressives are real fond of getting all over fundamentalist religion as the opiate of the masses, of which it is in many cases. But they don't check out what their own kind of fundamentalism sometimes, which is in the area of consumerism.
Yeah, and I think that's obviously it's a flip side of the debt issue as well. Debt becomes that much more daunting when your self worth in a society is a function of what you can buy, because it precludes you from being rich theoretically. And if that becomes your only agenda, the debt becomes that much more crushing. It's fascinating stuff, and we will put a link up to your book, and I hope to talk to you again soon. Bruce Levine, the book is Get Up, Stand Up, Uniting Populace, Energizing the Defeated, and Battling the Corporate Elite. We got to take a break. We'll be right back after this. Thanks for joining us.
Good to talk with you, Sam.
All right, we've got to take a break, folks. Be back in literally a minute. So I want to continue on our conversation. It dovetails nicely with Bruce Levine's appearance here on this program. So literally, as we are debating yesterday on the question of whether or not what we're seeing in Britain is a function just of a lot of irrational kids who decide out of the blue, I want a TV finally. And they go and bust it into shops to get a TV. And my point wasn't that impetus to go and grab a TV is the proper impetus, or that it will help from a political standpoint. I mean, I actually think like that consumerism, that one of the fail safes is that instead of going and, burning down, during the debate we were having yesterday, somebody IM'd me a picture of, something from Viva Vendetta with the picture of the Guy Fawkes mask and a quote about the symbolism involved in burning down a building and what building it is that you burn down. You burn down the Parliament building, the symbolism is far more important. And down at the bottom it says I'm not going to say the word. Because it's a little bit, it's British. It's more of a British word. But in Britain, they often use the euphemism for vagina. But it has a different meaning. So these morons are burning down the wrong building is the issue. And I think that is the point. You know, taking a TV doesn't necessarily communicate what your rage is about. But with all of that said, the question is this a function of austerity cuts in Britain? Is that the match that lights the tinderbox on fire? Well, literally, as we were having this debate, authors Jacopo Ponticelli and Hans Joachim Voth. Forgive me if I'm not pronouncing those correctly. Come out with a paper at the Center for Economic Policy Research, I think it is, .org, CEPR.org. Austerity and anarchy, budget cuts and social unrest in Europe. Does fiscal consolidation lead to social unrest? From the end of the Weimar Republic in Germany in the 1930s to anti-government demonstrations in Greece 2010-11, in this paper we assemble cross-country evidence for the period 1919 to the present, and examine the extent to which society has become unstable after budget cuts. The results show a clear positive correlation between fiscal retrenchment and instability. We also analyze interactions with various economic and political variables. While autocracies and democracies show broadly similar responses to budget cuts, countries with more constraints on the executive are less likely to see unrest as a result of austerity measures. So in other words, if there's some built-in constraints on the executive, i.e. the president or the prime minister, it's less likely, but there is a clear correlation between austerity and social unrest. And they defer... wait a second.
Who could that be?
Somebody's calling me. Hello? Hello? Hello?
Samuel.
Hello?
Samuel.
This is Sam.
This is Kathy.
Oh, Kathy, Catherine Harris.
Call me Kathy.
Okay, Kathy. Gosh, it's been a while. How are you?
I'm over the moon, Sam. It has been a whirlwind. I have been traveling and traveling. I've been to London. I've been to Houston's Reliance Stadium. I've been to the Midwest. I've been to Wisconsin. I'm breathless. Oh, also, I've been to Sandals Resort.
Wait, okay. No, hold on for a second now. I thought, you know, I got to say, I thought you were going to say, like, I've been to London, I've been France, I can see your underpants is what
I've seen somebody's underpants.
Well, I want to hear all about that. But what were you doing? Wait, what were you doing in London?
Well, I was joining the celebrations.
The celebrations?
The celebrations in the streets for the celebrations of austerity, the people celebrating for more austerity from Brixton to Camden Town to Liverpool.
Wait,
austerity.
I'm not.
They love it.
I'm sorry. I don't think people are celebrating.
They're celebrating like Mardi Gras. Now, there have been a few bad apples, but I'm afraid that might have been my fault because I was traveling with a photo of Mitch McConnell. I had a Mitch McConnell photo that I dropped in the street in Brixton, and then all of a sudden there was looting. Whoops!
Okay, so wait a second. So you went to Britain to celebrate austerity with people in the streets.
Yes, they love it. More, more, more. And do you know there's a new haircut cut, the austerity cut, that me and Kathy Ann, Kathy Nicholas, my new BFF, she and I got austerity cuts. It's a lot like the Dorothy Hamill wedge. Do you remember the wedge? The Dorothy Hamill cut. It's so cute. It's wash and go, Sam. Wash and go.
Kathy Nicholas, of course, is the, she is from, she's like the...
From Waukesha.
From Waukesha County in Wisconsin. She's the one who keeps holding back the ballots on all these important races.
Holding back? We call her St. Nicholas. Gifts just keep on coming. It's like Christmas every time Kathy St. Nicholas gets involved. She's a heck of a clerk and a wonderful gal. You know where I met her?
No.
Nitwit's Yarn Shop. We love to knit. We met at a place called Nitwit's. It's a craft shop, and they have notions, and we make sweaters and shrugs, which is the thing that just goes over your shoulders if you don't want to wear a full sweater.
A shrug.
It's a shrug. But, yeah, we met at Nitwit's.
You met Kathy Nicholas at Nitwits. Okay, so that's why I presume. Were you in Wisconsin for this recall vote?
Yes, I've been. Oh my God, how many miles I have! I have so many points now. That's why I got to go to Sandals Resort. It's so much fun at Sam's. I'm breathless, Sam, because also I want to talk about the new Apostolic Reformation movement at Reliant Stadium and the 8 mountains. I know they only talk about 7 mountains to conquer, but we have 8 mountains of revival and spiritual and political living.
Wait a second. I'm confused now. So wait a second. You were in Houston. Was that for the Rick Perry concert?
Yes.
Oh.
That will praise him. Praise him. It's a, you know, Sam, I'm sure you're aware of the, we're trying to roll back the theological enlightenment of the 18th century. You know, the pro-enlightenment clerics at the Sorbonne, of course, French. Well, you know, the pro-enlightenment clerics at the Sorbonne in the 18th century, they came to dominate the church's thinking. That's where all this progressive nonsense and communism came from.
From the enlightenment clerics at the Sorbonne.
Yeah, so you can imagine the impact on Roman Catholicism, and that's the socialist Obamacare. You can directly trace it back to the 18th century pro-enlightenment clerics at the Sorbonne.
Wait a second. So these people, they're responsible for both Obamacare and Roman Catholicism.
And the EPA.
And the EPA.
Yes.
Okay, and I have to ask you about this Rick Perry thing because, you know, Rick Perry, there's a lot of people who feel that he's going to jump into the race and that he is going to basically be the number one competitor for stealing votes from Michelle Bachmann. And I thought you were in firmly.
Michelle, my best, don't worry, Sam, don't worry. Wherever Rick Perry goeth, Michelle, my bell doth follow. You can put that in your pipe and smoke it. And you know who else I saw at Sandals Resort? Joseph the Plumber. He was at the resort. It was so much fun. We had an adult hopscotch league, and it was so much fun. And, you know, Marcus Bachmann was there, and he had nightly showings of the movie Xanadu. He loves that movie, starring Olivia Newton-John and Gene Kelly. Xanadu.
Wait a second. So you're in Sandals with Joseph the Plumber?
Joseph the Plumber and Marcus Bachmann.
What are you doing at Sandals? I guess maybe I have a wrong perception of what
they're part of a super PAC, and we just go and have some fun, and we try and roll back the theological enlightenment. It's a lot. It's so much fun. But, Sam, I want to talk about the eight mountains from the Reliant Stadium, the response, the 8 mountains.
What are the 8 mountains? You have to help me out here because I'm not 100% up on this.
The Apostolic Reformation movement, we have the 8 mountains, number one. We have to attack the mountain of government, media, arts and entertainment, Jesus' entrance strategy. We want to pray that God can get at our toughest stains. We want to pray for rain. We want to attack the Jezebel movement, the harlot movement, Oprah, and you know, you've heard of the Gorgon, the three-headed she-beast, the Gorgon.
Wait, is this all mountain number one? That's a
mountain,
lot of...
No. I just named you 8. And then 8-B, restless leg syndrome.
Well, there's actually now medication for that. But wait a second. What's the Dorgon?
Yeah, but the side effects increase gambling. That's a dangerous one. One of the side effects of Avacor for restless leg is increased gambling and weight gain. And Marcus is very upset about that. Because he always says, a moment on the lips, forever on the hips. And He's just very concerned about his weight, and you know, when he was showing Xanadu at Sandals, he felt very uncomfortable because he couldn't wear his resort wear collection of shorts and fun tops that he had.
I want to back up. What is Dorgon?
Back it up.
What is
just like the clerics from the Sorbonne? We got back it up. Yes, Sam, go ahead.
What is Dorgon?
The Gorgon, the three-headed she-beast.
Oh, I And what is that?
Remember Medusa? Well, similarly, the Gorgon is Oprah, Nancy Grace, and Giuliana Dipani, nay, Rancic from E.
That's
E!
The Gorgon?
Entertainment Channel, the Gorgon. Don't you read?
I do read. I don't. Where would I have found that in print?
The Gorgon mythological. Sam, I don't have the time. I don't have this kind of time to talk to you about these things. I can't give you education Gorgon 101. We have to talk about how Jesus hates the EPA. He hates collective bargaining.
Well, I'd like, we only have a minute or so left here. What I really would love to talk to you about is just to get a preview of what you expect to see tonight in the Republican primary debate.
The straw poll? No, that's Saturday.
Tonight is a Republican primary debate. Were you not aware of that?
No.
I'm
so sorry. I've been so busy flying. What are you talking about?
Well, there's a Republican primary debate tonight. I mean, let me...
Oh, my goodness. Where is my head? Kathy Ann! Kathy, do you know about this? She's nodding. Oh, you know what, Sam? I forgot. I'm so excited. You know what else happened? You know the idea that the Obama administration is going to go after Mitt Romney for being weird?
Yeah.
Guess who started that rumor?
Who did?
Kathy Ann.
Yeah.
She whispered it to Howard Fineman. You know how Howard Fineman, all his information comes from someone he spoke to on the Hill?
Right, yes.
Guess who spoke to him on the Hill? Yeah. He doesn't know who's who. It was Kathy Ann.
Kathy Ann, like you?
Kathy Ann, Kathy St. Nicholas.
Oh, Kathy Ann. Oh. So wait, but she's from Wisconsin. What's she doing on the Hill?
She was shouting and whispering, and Howard Fineman, who just likes to get his information from hearsay, as you know. So we told him that the Obama administration was going to accuse Romney of being weird, and that they were going to, quote-unquote, kill him, and the media went insane.
So now,
as you know, the Obama administration is going to back way off that. It works like a charm, Sam. These people are so predictable.
Wow. Yeah, I had no idea.
I'm sorry, I need a paper bag. I'm hyperventilating with joy.
But aren't you in any way, you're not a pro-Romney gal, are you?
No!
Oh.
But with anything to divert the attention, it's just a fun game. You just tell the media of what the Democrats are going to do from an unnamed source that spoke to Howard Fineman, and he repeats it, and then it goes on from there. It's like a golden shower, showers of gold raining down on our faces from on high, from Alec. And the Koch brothers, showers of gold, just golden showers. That's trickle down for you.
No, I
That's
understand.
Trickle down, maybe at its finest.
Well, Catherine Harris, I want to thank you for almost previewing tonight's Republican debate for us. I hope we can talk to you soon, just to give us.
Where are the debates? What are you talking about?
I'm not even sure. I think they.
You might be misinformed, because when I saw Joseph the Plumber had sandals, he didn't say anything. And when I was at the Joy-a-thon in London and Camden and Brixton and Liverpool, no one said anything about this. They were just praising David Cameron and saying, please, sir, more austerity. We love it.
I'm not even sure where this debate is, for gosh sakes.
I don't think there is one.
No, I'm pretty sure it is. I know Huntsman's going to be in this debate for the first time. And
who?
John Huntsman.
I don't know who that is.
He's running for president for the Republicans, but I guess you probably wouldn't have heard of him.
I don't know who that is.
Well, yeah.
But I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I've got to go. But Catherine Harris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. When can we talk again?
Well, very soon. I would love to.
Okay, call me.
Okay. I'll call you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Wow. Catherine Harris. All right, well, we're going to continue this this talk about the British riots. I've got a piece, maybe I'll save it for tomorrow, but a billionaire has come out with a piece, not the billionaire you think it was, come out with a piece that Bernie Sanders could have written, frankly. Just to give you a sense of just how insane our politics have become. How off the rails. And this is not just a function of politicians. It's also a function of our corporate media, who love this deficit debate. Loved it. Even though it was about as relevant to our economy as, I don't know, the playoff race in the American League East, which the Sox are winning. Folks, if you have the opportunity to become a member, please do. You'd be able to hear this conversation coming up next. But more importantly, even more importantly than your own gratification, would be my gratification. And the ability just to do the first half of this show. Because it ain't easy. Unless you got the greasy. I don't know. I can't make that rhyme. But we need your support desperately. Become a member today at majority.fm. It is 50 cents a day. Just get a smaller size coffee. Make your own coffee at home. In fact, buy coffee from justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Save money that way. Get fair trade coffee. Get organic coffee. Save yourself the super venti that you're paying $8 for. Support this program. Don't you see? I've just completely fixed your entire life. And also, if you got to buy that junk from Amazon, at least do it through our link, folks. And I already mentioned donate your account. All right. So see you on the flip side. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call us at 646-257-3920 or Skype us at Majority Live. Be right back after this.